Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online or on our podcast. Coming up at the end of this hour, an interview with Senator Al Franken about his new memoir, which is out this week. But first, our latest conversation with Counterstories.
Good morning and welcome to Counterstories, a conversation for people of color, by people of color, and everyone else. My name is Luz Maria Frias, and I'm hosting today. We don't have Anthony Galway, but we have a superstar guest with us today.
Sharon Smith Akinsanya, the founder of the People of Color Career Fair.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Don Eubanks, assistant professor at Metropolitan State University.
Hui Li, a media professional.
And Tom Weber from NPR.
We have so many things to talk about this morning, and really it's a matter of competing interests with how much is going on in our community. And maybe we'll start with the tragic attack that occurred in Portland just late last week and into the weekend, where two young girls, and they keep being referred to by media as women, and actually it's a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old
girl.
There's also two young girls who were riding on public transit, Muslim. One girl is actually Muslim. The other was her friend, who were being attacked verbally by what now has been identified as a white supremacist. And three passengers came to her defense. And tragically, the attacker then pulled a knife against these three men. And two of them were killed as a result, and one of them ended up in critical care in the hospital. And it really, I think, shocked the nation to see that. And it was really something that was being emphasized on social media, but it was very odd not to have the President of the United States make a statement on it. And I think that was something that people on social media were really questioning, that any other type of attack of this sort, in terms of a quote-unquote terrorist attack, is easily covered and commented by our leader, but this wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the question then was asked as to why not, and why there was that absence where two young girls were being verbally attacked for being Muslim. So what are folks feeling about that?
Just yesterday, President Trump did tweet about it. And he said, "The violent attacks in Portland on Friday are unacceptable. The victims are standing up to hate and intolerance. Our prayers are with them."
I missed that tweet of the many that come out.
That tweet that come late. But
the situation in Portland, I don't know if I found it as surprising or shocking, mainly because I feel like that's basically what this country has become, where people have been feeling like their racism, their xenophobia is okay and is accepted in this world. And if it's not, that's your problem, not mine, right? It reminds me of the situation that happened here in the Twin Cities, where a local artist used a cell phone to shoot video of a transit police asking a passenger on the Green Line if he had his papers, if he was here illegally. The video went viral. There was a lot of press about it. And, you know, the artist spoke up and said, "Are you allowed to ask that?" And really put the cop on the spot. And now we're learning that the gentleman who was being questioned by that transit police officer is being deported. And it just starts to make me wonder, these situations where you're stepping in, right? You're standing up for what's right, but worse things are happening. For instance, if this artist had not stood up for this young man on the green train, would he have ended up being picked up at the next stop like he was? Maybe the transit police felt like, oh, shoot, someone's got me on camera now, right? I'm going to call for backup. If these young men hadn't stepped in to protect these young girls, what would happen? They may have just walked off the bus and gone home and had a really bad interaction with a white supremacist. Or they might have been the ones killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's
at
what point are we stepping up to injustice but making it worse?
I think we always have to step up to do the right thing. And yes, we all run the risk. But that's what good people do. And we have to fight this madness, this lack of decorum, this outrageousness that is being normalized in this country. You know, my 20-year-old, my daughter, my 10-year-old nieces, they know how to behave themselves better than what's being exhibited in the nation's highest office in the land. It's not acceptable, and we are normalizing it, and it must stop. And we have to continue to have conversations like what we're having here today that point that out. And so you're right, Halee, when you talk about the fact that, you know, people feeling like they've got permission to act a fool. Mm-hmm. Things that they would never have done 6 months ago. They might have thought about it, but they would never have done because people would have jumped all over their behinds. And we have to continue to jump all over their behinds no matter what.
I love that you're here, Sharon, and I just want to let you know that Halee is the eternal pessimist in the group. So I heard Sharon say, you got to keep going for it. I could hear from across the room, even though Halee didn't say anything, I could just see Halee thinking, no, I don't feel that optimistic about it.
It's true. I rely on the other folks in counter stories to keep my hopes up.
And I so appreciate you saying it because I would be the incurable optimist here in the group. I would echo your statements, Sharon, but also I would say when we look at historically what we have been messaged by the media, and I would say commercial media and rather than public radio, we know that there are messages there that really further the othering of people, right? And the othering, the MTC. Thank you. Example in particular where that officer acted beyond the scope of his authority.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The MTC transit police are not allowed to be asking those questions. And certainly then his own bias came in to play in that situation. We know that public safety officers, law enforcement, in fact, have a very clear delineation between local authority and federal authority in terms of the scope of their work, because they want to make sure that everyone feels that they can report a crime mm-hmm. and have that community trust with police. So nothing is more ostracizing than to have a MTC officer then go beyond his or her jurisdiction and ask for immigration status, not allowed. And actually, he was terminated afterwards, mm-hmm. my understanding is. And secondly, when we look at the limited resources that local law enforcement departments have, they don't have the resources to be able to do immigration work, which is federally funded, mm-hmm. as well as local work. So there are many reasons why. And the last reason I would say is exactly what just happened in that situation was profiling mm-hmm. and how this officer decided that this man who appeared to be Latino was open game, so to speak, for being asked and questioned about his immigration status. Would he have done that to Tom Weber? You know,
no.
would he have done that to a Don Eubanks?
No, absolutely
not. Someone who
not.
Doesn't
bigger
look
than
like
him,
that.
And the artist who spoke up, Ricardo, is Puerto Rican. And I was just thinking, I was like, Ricardo, he could have turned that on you. But of course, Ricardo is a citizen and all that stuff and probably would have had a really good comeback for it.
Mm-hmm. But see, the officer, how do you prove your citizenship? If any one of us
That's
in
right.
the room is asked by an officer, prove that you're a U.S. citizen.
Show me your papers.
Exactly. What do you produce to show that? There is, unless you have your passport, yeah. and who walks around with a passport?
Right.
Unless you're at the airport and you're going to be traveling internationally. But right. most of us don't have that passport. And that's the inherent bias that we are trying to alleviate and escape when we're looking at what's called a separation ordinance, which is very different than what society and media is promoting as a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. The separation ordinance is really about protecting the difference and between what local authority is and what federal authority is, and not having a local law enforcement or city employee of any sort proactively ask about someone's mm-hmm. immigration status.
And that's key. You used to work for the city of St. Paul. So this is a big topic. And Don has been a part of this in Roseville, because Roseville is getting into the sanctuary city conversation. And Don, we were talking before we recorded, but like, I think it's just a big misconception. If you call yourself a sanctuary city, and frankly, I had the mayor on of St. Paul, and he says, we're not a sanctuary city.
Mm. We're not.
He's trying to pat that idea down.
Right. In 2006, the anti-immigrant community legislators and others really worked hard to craft this negative connotation to what is called a separation ordinance by saying that it's a sanctuary city. Clearly, as Minneapolis is a separation ordinance city, that MTC transaction and event happened in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. that gentleman was still deported.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you have, as a sanctuary applies, protection from being deported. You're not. The protection comes from limiting the authority of a local employee at the city level from proactively engaging in questioning someone's immigration status. Mm-hmm. It is a separation ordinance. It's pejoratively referred to and defined by the other side as a sanctuary city.
Mm-hmm. So, Don, you're kind of on this move in Roseville after the Philandra Castile incident.
Right.
And you got kind of involved, and now they're talking about being a sanctuary city?
Well, they had meetings in the community where they brought folks from various immigration groups and different things to talk about what that actually is and what it means and what it doesn't mean. Now, I wasn't able to attend those meetings, but I have been part of that inner group working with the mayor and city council individuals and other community members, the chief of police, as a result of the Philandra Castile meeting and shooting, and it has kind of morphed into this discussion. So even as that group, we discussed the fact that the term sanctuary doesn't really mean that. Mm. But what happens is when media, the Star and Tribune, and others were there and have been kind of reporting on this, where and they have been using that language in their reporting. If you read in between the lines, you know, you can see that, because there's the things, what does that effort actually mean? Because the chief of police has clearly said in Roseville that his officers don't ask for people's statuses, and they never will, right? And so I'm not sure where this discussion is going to go in terms of what Roseville City Council's actually going to say or do. You know, there are some conservative members that make up that city council. And there's a large portion of the community that hasn't come out to these community meetings. So we haven't heard the flip side from maybe individuals who aren't supportive of any, because this, I see this more as a community rising up to what they're seeing around them in the country and wanting to do something to help that portion of our community.
Right.
So, you know, that's where I see this
so if
happening.
So if the police have already said they don't ask for immigration status, then doesn't that just make you sanctuary city?
So to be clear, again, sanctuary cities is pejorative, so we're not going to use sanctuary city. Yes. We're going to say a separation ordinance.
Okay.
So let's scrub this clean.
Okay.
But just to say that over again, I mean, what you're saying is the term is loaded and doesn't mean what it means. And
exactly.
Your argument is that whenever you hear the phrase sanctuary city, it should raise your antenna because there isn't actually a thing called
Correct.
A sanctuary
Correct.
City.
So with cities that have separation ordinances, so that's how they're legally actually referenced, the scope of that ordinance goes beyond law enforcement. So say, for instance, you're going to the city to get your water turned on, or perhaps you need a permit for construction, remodeling your home. Mm-hmm. It extends to all of those city services. So if Roseville police... The chief is already saying that the police officers don't engage in that proactive questioning, mm-hmm. it's still important to have it in an ordinance because that chief will not be there in perpetuity, right? So there are other chiefs that come, and we want to make sure that that ordinance is in place. But then the scope of that work then also goes to all those other examples I just referenced, mm-hmm. so that the immigrants who live in that city are feeling that they're feeling safe in asking for those acts.
Or safer.
Safer,
right. A similar type situation existed when I worked at the Department of Human Services under the Bush administration. And there were similar efforts from the Bush administration concerning immigrants and immigration. Well, the state itself took the stance that as state employees, none of us would ask any questions about immigration. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the feds were pushing a whole different thing, but as a state employee, we were instructed we will not ask. So that's what Luz is trying to describe. And that term sanctuary city, and I understand exactly what she's saying because it's a loaded term. And it's like how language and its use, you know, a certain party has been very, very good mm-hmm. at naming and then giving weight behind those names. I mean, look mm-hmm. what they did to welfare.
The Affordable Care Act that was then termed as Obamacare, right?
Exactly.
It's all about framing.
That's right.
And they have done a fantastic job at framing all of this so that even the use of the term to certain individuals raises alarms. And, you know, and so I agree 100% with what Luz is saying. And for me, being a part of that, we are aware that that term doesn't carry any weight, you know, but for me, it's the feeling of the community wanting to step up and do something positive, even when they find out that legally it doesn't really amount to a lot.
But let me be clear on this language. If Minnesota is going to remain the state that it is in terms of growth and economy and, you know, economics and environment and all the things that we love, we need to fix this. We need to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to change, help, and support to make sure that all folks who live in this state can access everything that it has to offer. If we don't, we're in big doo-doo trouble. Economically and when it comes to our future workforce, because the majority of our population is coming from communities of color.
And just for people to know, Sharon, your whole job, your whole work is working with big companies, including Fortune 500s.
All Fortune 5s
in Minnesota. Minnesota has this rich tradition of Fortune 5s.
Absolutely.
And you work with them
directly
to get their workforce for the future.
Absolutely. We need to make sure, and trust me, the corporations get this, and we're going to be fighting, everybody's going to be fighting. We must make sure that white people know that if we don't fix it, it is not a great place to live for them either.
Right.
And that's the fact.
And I think, you know, when we look at Rollsville, two other things that I'd like to note, and then we can turn our direction elsewhere. But Rollsville would be the first suburb. In the country, is my understanding, to pass an ordinance. So that in itself would encourage, hopefully, other suburbs around not only Minnesota but nationally to step up and engage in a similar effort to pass these ordinances and create a more welcoming environment, first and foremost. Secondly, Rollsville actually, as a first-ring suburb, has almost gotten to 25% people of color and immigrants, and most people don't really think about that, but that in fact is true. And to Sharon's point earlier, the growth of our community is seen within communities of color and immigrant communities.
That's
right. So that's where the future workforce is. And as we look at the workforce shortage that is part of the headlines almost on a weekly basis, mm-hmm. we need to understand that individuals from immigrant communities as well as people of color are strengths and assets in our community rather than seeing it as a deficit. And speaking of police, I can't help but to think about the start of the Philando Castile trial and jury selection. And we know that that is something that's really painful in our community right now. And knowing how much of that then will be a part of our lives for the next couple of weeks, even months, depending on how it progresses with the trial. And Sharon, I know that you have some.
Well, my thought was that, you know, it was really, I was concerned about the jury selection. And I know that that's where we have to start. And what that may look like. And we don't know that yet. I think they've impaneled 50 or so. They're just starting.
Yeah.
But I know that that's very important in how the community, all of us, will be feeling about how things move forward. Because really it's about fairness and justice. And you have to have different points of view and diverse points of view and diverse experiences on that panel. You have to have people on that panel who are afraid to be stopped by police, you know, so they can describe how that must feel.
And, you know, and I don't disagree with what you're saying, because from our perspective, to us, that would be fair and equitable. From the rhetoric that I'm hearing from the defense, however, their perspective is totally different. Right. And you know they're going to be working very hard to eliminate everyone that you just described.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right?
And somebody's going to have to fight hard, because I could be on that jury and be able to set aside that experience to be fair. And they would need somebody like that to be able to. You have to have that experience in order to be able to just. You can't. I mean, it just won't be fair any other way.
One thing that comes to mind in terms of having a pool of jurors that is diverse is that one of the sources that jury selection takes place from, and not solely, is voting records.
That's right.
And when you look at voting records,
yeah,
we don't have the strongest turnout of people of color. And then we look at the African-American community, certainly with the restrictions that are in place, that further restricts it. And we know that research shows that if a parent votes, then their children will vote.
Correct.
There's a direct correlation. So there's a real disservice when we limit voting rights by way of other activities that are happening that further disenfranchise an entire community. And that's a big concern.
As it should be.
So a question. So using voter registration as a mean to select
that's one.
But how is that used to, I mean, so I'm a voter. I have voted my entire adult life.
Yeah, but if you're registered to vote, you're in the pool. And Luz's point is, if you're not even registered.
You may not be in that pool.
But even in that pool.
So 25% of African Americans in Minnesota they're on paper, either supervised release, parole, or probation.
So they can't vote. And
those restrictions can be anywhere from 3 years to 10 years or even more.
Right.
So for that period of time, and that's why there's a movement, Restore the Vote Minnesota, to restore those votes. Other states around the country don't have that limited requirement. So it's a systemic problem that further disenfranchises an entire community, because disproportionately African Americans are represented in that pool.
Okay, see, and so that I think helps people understand then how that becomes an additional barrier to being evenly distributed across the community, which is why I was asking.
It's called systematic racism.
Exactly.
Just to be clear.
I mean, that's how we would describe it.
But that is it.
And it gets harder to explain to people exactly what that is and what it means. And so that's why I asked the question, because then that helps individuals, I think, understand then how that ties in.
Yeah, it all
loops together. How all this ties in.
And it's an endless cycle.
It sucks.
Leah has spoken.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's going to be largely white. People are going to complain. It's going to be largely people of color. People are going to complain. Whatever way, you know, if it's all white people, a majority of white people, and then the officer gets off, that's going to be a whole issue. If it's all black people or people of color and the officer gets found guilty, it's right. There's just so much behind this one. Well, this one thing.
It's not just one thing. In this arena, I'm feeling more. My feelings are more aligned with how you usually feel, Hilly, because what was it? 2 weeks ago? Was it 2-3 weeks ago that a white woman police officer in Oklahoma
got acquitted?
Was found innocent. Was acquitted of shooting another black male, totally unarmed, by simply, and her defense was she was afraid for her life. Which is this incident that just happened in Bassett Creek with this young black male who apparently, now that reports have come out, has been dealing with some emotional issues, all right, some mental health issues, and had a air gun or, you know,
an
some
air pistol.
It was an air pistol,
that was
whatever.
Just a week ago in Minnesota.
Exactly. And you have 7-8 officers all stating that they were fearful for their lives. If police officers are that afraid, they should not be carrying a gun legally to protect and serve. If they can see a person of color, a black person, and I've said this many times in this podcast, you know, we should be screening these individuals out psychologically because they're not fit to serve.
That's right.
If you're that afraid of a person of color, find another job.
That's right.
But the fact that they get acquitted, to me, traumatizes me every time I hear one of these decisions.
Right, John.
I live in trauma day in and day out. And so this Castile case, I'm not holding, I mean, I want, you know, for me, I would hope that justice is served. Am I optimistic? I'm trying to hold on to what optimism I have now, but I'm serious. I'm being beat down day in and day out when we can have two people step up to the plate and they end up dead. Mm-hmm. And it's not even being talked about, or the guy's not being charged with a hate crime.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're not even acknowledging the fact that he's a white supremacist. I mean, you know, this just goes against every fiber in my body. It just screams injustice.
And I wouldn't say the one situation, or, you know, that this is a standout situation. But one thing that does concern me is that the officer himself in the Philander Castile case is a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see how that plays into it as well, right?
Which we've said, at least anecdotically, that when the officers are from communities of color, there's a higher conviction rate.
That's right.
In terms of guilty rate. We don't know that to be true factually, but anecdotally, I think folks have that understanding and that observation that's where we're seeing at least a trend of some sort where that's the case.
Mm-hmm. And the other trend that we're seeing are states now stepping up separately and beginning trying to get legislation passed that they're referring to as Blue Lives Matter, where harming or killing a police officer now will be categorized as a hate crime. And so the fact that they're taking the Black Lives Matter mantle and what that meant in terms of just black people standing up and saying, I am somebody,
right.
You know, please just honor me as a human being, is now being misconstrued, misportrayed, being labeled. All right. I mean,
it's what you were saying before, Don, when they take these names, right, and they use these
language.
Names. It's the language. It's the language. And they turn it around and people start thinking, Well, yeah, I think police lives matter too. So then they get behind this thing, right? Or
right.
I like the idea of having the right to work. So they get behind these sort of plans that are actually the opposite
of, or what? Yeah.
Of what it is because of the language.
There's quite a bit of, I think, maneuvering of words that play really well for audiences. And there's a lot of research on this. Eric Deggans at the national level wrote a book, Race Baiter, and talks about the role of media really doing this, right? And the people behind those messaging, whether it's Breitbart News or other conservative modems that really look at twisting, you know, the meaning of things such that it makes sense, and a fair number of folks don't take the time or the effort to really do the legwork on this and figure out the meaning of it. So they stand behind the label, and that's as far as they get in terms of their understanding. And unfortunately, then it's to the detriment of us all. One other topic that really, I think, struck a chord first on social media and then I think went mainstream was the issue of the exhibit at the Walker this weekend. And, of course, it was the gallows from the hanging of indigenous people, 38, and how that was then being promoted as an art piece. And community really came out to speak against it. And Don, I know that you're really wanting to share your views on this, and we'll chime in.
It was first brought to my attention on social media by my Native American friends when 'cause they'd been kind of doing a part parcel of what the Walker's putting in that sculpture garden. And then it broke that part of the exhibit was on scaffolds used in U.S. history. And it was brought forward that a replica of the scaffold that was built in Mankato to hang 38 Dakota warriors who, you know, had been approved by Abraham Lincoln, because that number had actually been whittled down. That, you know, the state of Minnesota submitted like 300 names. And Lincoln's attorneys whittled that down to 38 for individuals who were standing up, fighting for their homeland, fighting for food, fighting for their life, fighting for their right, and yet 38 of them were hung. And simultaneously, the largest mass hanging in the United States. And the fact that the Walker Arts Center thought the artist behind that, you know, apparently had displayed this over in Europe.
And the artist, to be clear, is not from the indigenous community.
No, nor is he from Minnesota. And so nobody thought that there was anything wrong with putting that exhibit here until they started constructing it. And then the word got out, and it's like, all heck broke loose in the American Indian community. How can you be so insensitive to display something like this? And so, you know, meetings are going on with Dakota elders. Mm-hmm. You know, the artist, it's himself, has written a statement. I read a statement where he was talking about what it was that he was attempting to try to get across,
which was very provocative, to try to test. In his view, his idea was, "I'm going to test my fellow white Americans' expectations or views on."
I know.
That's how you feel, but that is what he said.
Help me understand, Don. Maybe I missed this part of the story. How do you get this far without having meetings?
Yes.
Well,
with
it is a major facepalm, right?
Can you help me? I mean, how do you
see? That is what the community doesn't understand, and that is what
did they have meetings?
No, the Walker director at the Walker Arts Center did not communicate with anyone from the community.
It doesn't make any sense
about this exhibit, and what made it worse is for me personally as a Native American,
sure.
is in 1970, 70, 71, the Walker Arts Center brought an exhibit here to the Twin Cities called the American Indian Art Form and Tradition Show. And this was one of the first shows of its kind because for me as a Native American, everything that was displayed were not art objects. They were objects that were created that were either utensils, they were spoons. You know, they were all things that we used in our culture from day-to-day life. They were displayed as art, objects, okay? Which thus the name Art Form and Tradition Show. But the fact that, and they did that in conjunction with the American Indian community. In fact, the reason why I know so much about it is because as I was a student in high school, there I forget the exact number, but there were 15 or 20 of us that were selected from Minneapolis Public High Schools. We were tutored by the Walker Arts Center, and we served as tour guides. So for me personally, I know the Walker had that sensitivity. That was in the 70s. How can we be here in 2017 and then have them do something like this? It's like
it just blew me away. It literally doesn't make any sense to me.
Does it make you crazy? Did anybody get fired? Help me.
So, you know, one other point that I think is really salient here is that your average Minnesotan is unaware that we have 11 reservations
in
Minnesota. And we, as a community, don't hear that often enough. Certainly we're not taught that in school. And mainstream media is not helping drive that message. So for some people who are not within kind of this race equity lens, social justice, are thinking, what's the big deal? Why? And they're feeling blindsided as well until they start listening to conversations such as this. And I've said just over the weekend, imagine if any art institution decided to bring a gas chamber, from the Jewish, the Holocaust,
Auschwitz,
and decide to make it art.
Yes.
It shocks the conscience. And so it's about having that. It's about having this contextualization as well about what it is, right? And why it has struck a chord so offensively, not only in the American Indian community, but I think just
everybody.
Around.
Just around.
Just everybody. Just, yeah. I mean, as an artist, I'm super offended because on the day that there was the big protest at the Walker, there was also a group of Native American folks having a little art showing. Nobody went there. Because all of the Americans had gone to the Walker, right? And so it's like, and they're paying this guy $75,000 to make this sculpture when we're struggling here in our communities of color and indigenous communities to have our art shown in a coffee shop or our art shown in a public place, right? So we're struggling, but they're giving $75,000 to this guy. And look, his statement, all whatever. You're trying to teach other white people, but guess what? It's not your story.
That's right.
Okay? I'm sick of white people thinking, I'm just going to educate other white people. It's not your story. And if that was your intent, then why not talk to people in the Dakota community?
And you know, one of the guests on Counter Stories that we brought in, Rihanna Yazzie, posted,
right?
Because it was her production that no one showed up for her last night. Because everyone that would have showed up was at the protest, ensuring that the Walker closed that damn thing down.
Right.
And so, and that's what you're talking about. And so, like I said, it just boggles the mind. But what it reminds me, because Lou's brought up the fact that, one of the classes I teach at Metro is the comparative racial and ethnic analysis class. And I start each class asking that one simple question: how many reservations do we have in Minnesota, and who can name them? And it's been 4 years, and I haven't had a single student yet be able to answer that.
We need more awareness on that. And to end on a positive note, as I dare to be always doing, is that the protest that did assemble at the Walker on Saturday was really a diverse group of people. It wasn't just members of the American Indian Indigenous community. It really was a reflection of the allies that are supportive of one another. And we're seeing more of that. And that gives me hope.
And Minnesota, please keep that up.
Keep doing that, yes.
Please.
Please keep doing that.
We have to take care of Halee.
Please.
But we've had
a lively
I was going to say a heck of a conversation this morning with many, many more issues, unfortunately, to further discuss. But with that in mind, I think we'll close it off for today. With that, I'm Luz Maria Frias.
Don Eubanks.
Sharon Smith-Akinsanya.
Lee.
Tom Weber.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.